The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal Credit Union has the tools and services to help you put your money to work, and you can get started with as little as $5. Small steps now can mean big earnings later. Learn more at NavyFederal.org/save. Federally insured by NCUA.
Team Never Quit Radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit Podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Welcome back to the Team Never Quit Podcast. Thank you guys for listening, watching, most importantly, subscribing. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel because we're dropping new videos soon, very soon. And we've got some fun stuff on the way, like arm wrestling contest.
How soon?
Hot sauce contest.
Hot wings.
Some challenges.
We actually have an arm wrestling contest coming up,
yeah,
too.
That's what you're saying.
Oh, that's what I was going to tell you. I saw Over the Top was on the TV menu this morning. What a coincidence.
What a coincidence.
So just so you know, our producers and Marcus have challenged each other to an arm wrestling contest.
That's not true. He challenged me, so if I lose,
There's a lot of shit talking going on.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So
it's going to be live.
We're going to have the table, the whole nine
pay-per-view.
Yards. I'm going to wear the shoes.
You can come in and ref if you want. How about that?
I like that.
I know, yeah. Bro, because you have one of those ref heads now.
We'll get you the
zebra
shirt.
You know what I mean?
Shirt.
Like, you look all sophisticated and stuff.
We got a Patreon question for you guys. Dakota Harvey asks, what's the most memorable story from your time in the teams? Do you have one you can share, or do we just need to share the Texas Roadhouse story?
We don't have time for that.
That's a great question, but that's a long, I mean, the detailed story with the thing.
With the thing.
So as soon as you said the best story, I mean, I had so many of them blow through my head, my Rolodex.
In the community, it's like Vegas. Stays in Vegas.
What happens? Okay, Dakota.
Sorry, buddy.
Sorry. Okay, how about this one? Tactical shotgun of choice for homeowners.
D12.
Ooh. I got a Benelli.
D12.
Extended tube.
I have one of those too, but that D12 sawed off. It's about, what is it, 2 feet long, side by side. Every time you pump that slide back, I keep that sucker hidden. That's my go-to.
I've got a Benelli with an extended tube with short rounds in it, slug, and double op buck.
Yeah, for home protection, always go with a shotgun. It's the most recognizable sound on the planet is when that sucker racks back. Man, there's no other sound like it.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think, Kevin? You know you go along with that, buddy?
I think that's a good choice right there.
Yep. You got anything else, or just you shotgun?
Green Beret, like a flamethrower or something?
Rocket launcher? You guys are...
you probably got an engineer.
Right? Yeah. I know, right? Your whole house is probably...
He's got like claymores and shit.
Yeah.
Hey, if you want to ask your question, make sure to join us, patreon.com/teamneverquit. Hey, guys, we've got a great guest in store. In 2011, on his second Special Forces deployment in Afghanistan, Kevin Flike was shot in the abdomen and sustained life-threatening injuries. He survived, but was left with 20% of his colon removed, a fractured hip, a damaged femoral nerve, and endured 6 surgeries that left him with over 40 inches of scars. Today's Kevin's mission is to inspire others and help with their own journey to physical, mental, and emotional healing. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for having me on the show here today.
Oh, yeah, bro. Hey, we got a file on you and everything.
Since
check it out.
Nobody welcome to the team, baby. It says classified.
It only took getting shot and doing everything else, but now we're together.
And I want everybody, all the listeners, to know that Kevin, he shaves his head, and he has one of those perfectly shaved heads that looks good when you're shaving. Because Marks and I have like really bushy eyebrows, so when we shave our heads, we look dumb as shit.
That's like weird,
like
dude.
A gangbanger.
Gangbanger.
Embrace it, bro. You look good.
So I finally learned to embrace who I am, and it's a shaved head type of guy.
It took going through.
Hey,
did
the missus tell you? Is like, hey, take it off, or did you just finally? Yeah.
When you finally make the decision to shave your head, you're typically the last person out there to realize
who really wants to do it. Yeah, because you think the rest of it looks good. I was giving him a hard time. I told him he had a good Roy McCracken going on from the pictures that I saw of him.
So do you have one of those head blades?
Not Roy, Earn. Big Earn.
Yeah. Earn McCracken. Yeah. Bill Murray. Sorry, Bill.
A lot of people used to say it was like Hezekiah Munson, too, from Kingpin.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Big Earn.
Big Earn, the bowler. Bill
Murray's character.
Yep. So yeah, that was my nickname going to the Q course with Munson.
Oh my God.
You're kidding me.
Because of Kingpin.
Fun with this.
I nailed it. Bro.
Yeah, you got
I nailed
it. Nice.
Kevin, why don't you take us back?
My celebrity lookalike is Woody Harrelson. That's what a lot of people pick.
You do.
Look, have you met him?
You have.
Not yet.
Oh, we got to get that done too. I never met him.
You do look like a young Woody.
I'd like to meet him.
I'm thinking more like Cheers, Woody, you know, right now.
Just started watching Cheers during the quarantine.
I was going with the White Man Can't Jump, Woody.
I'll take that one too.
Yeah, man.
That's a great movie.
About that. That's good.
Great movie. I like it. Wesley.
With the West, the Snipe Man.
Kevin, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm originally from a small town in upstate New York called Stillwater. I actually grew up right next to the Saratoga battlefield from the Revolutionary War. And so I think kind of the proximity to where I grew up and the history of the area, you know, the military was something that was pretty inherent in my life. You know, with my father, he never served. My grandfather was in World War II, and that was kind of something that was incredibly prominent within our family. Some of my earliest memories are watching like History Channel documentaries on the Battle of the Bulge. So that was just something that was really prevalent in my family. And the town I grew up in was amazing. Small town, America. I had great coaches, teachers, mentors. They set the foundation for really who I am, and also had great parents. And my father, he graduated second to last in his high school class, didn't finish college, but had this incredible desire and drive to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, set up a bunch of companies, failed a bunch of times until he finally hit it big with an idea. And so that was kind of the environment that I grew up in, right? Where you have an idea, you have something that you, a concept of something, and if you're willing to do whatever it takes to get it, you can get it. And that was what my parents really installed in me. It's like, there's nothing in life out there that you can't have if you're not willing to work hard enough for it. And every day I'd leave to go to school, my mom would kiss me on the cheek and she would say, "Hey, Kevin, look, you're a flight, you're an achiever," right? Like, it set the tempo for the day for me. Nothing was going to get handed to me. I had to go out there and achieve. And so I think coupled with growing up in this family business and seeing what you can do if you put your mind to it, and having a mother who just like completely believed in me, really showed me there's just nothing out there that I wasn't capable of doing if I wanted to. I was fortunate. I got to go to an all boys Catholic military school. I didn't feel very fortunate at the time. Like, that was
say. That doesn't sound like fun at all.
That's a hell of a lineup.
It was great looking back. Definitely not great when you're marching instead of going to gym class and stuff like that. But similar to you, Marcus, right? I was 14 and I'm sitting in my military science class and I see a Navy SEAL Hell Week video. We got to watch that old Discovery Channel special.
Oh, the silent option.
Oh, the silent option. That was the deal.
Yeah. Half the class isn't paying attention because they're 14. The other half's looking out the window. You know, most people are like, why would anybody want to do that? And I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I found my calling in life. Like,
right when he saw it. Same thing. When we saw that video, I was like,
that's what we're going to do.
That's what we're going to do right there.
So for me, right at 14, I'm like, I want to be in special operations, right? It was kind of this fascination, how hard it is, the camaraderie, right? The barrier to entry, the dangerousness of the missions. And you know, at this the school, the Catholic school, they taught me the biggest three things were to love God, love country, and put others above yourself. And so to me, this just fell in my lap of like, this is the way to love country, to serve mankind, to put other people above myself. And so it was just this fascination that I had. And then in my senior year of high school, that's when 9/11 happened. And so it goes from like this fascination to, all right, this is your duty to do this. And, you know, ultimately went to college fully with the intention of saying, like, when I graduate, I'm going to join the military once I graduate from college here.
Did you do well in undergrad?
I didn't really do great. And it's partially because I kind of had this pull all the time of like, hey, there's this war going on right now.
You're in the wrong spot.
You know, they're out there fighting and I'm here partying, playing college football and the president of my fraternity. And I think that really, really nagged on me quite a bit throughout that whole process. So it took me a little while to kind of turn it up, I guess, academically. But, you know, throughout that process, I knew I wanted to go into special ops and really kind of specifically the Green Berets. So I minored in Mandarin Chinese. I minored.
Are you kidding me?
No wonder you didn't do well in college.
No wonder.
Dude.
God almighty, son. I took 19 years of Spanish. I don't even understand it.
Oh yeah. Ola.
I said to my dad one day, my dad, I got to learn another language for what I want to do afterwards in the military. I'm either going to learn Spanish or Mandarin Chinese. And he goes, I do a lot of business. You know, all my business is with Chinese companies. You got to learn Mandarin Chinese. And so I'm like, all right, dad, I'll do that. And then the first class I'm sitting in there and I'm like, why didn't I choose Spanish?
Bro, did you, what was your language after the queue?
It was Mandarin.
Oh, you went back. Okay. Cause you had a pre, cause you'd already been. All right, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, tailored my studies towards, really to going into the special forces. And, you know, the more I looked at everything, I looked under the special operations umbrella for me, the Green Beret mission, De Oppresso Liber, to free the oppressed, just really spoke to me at the time. And to have that opportunity to do the foreign internal defense, you know, to work hand in hand with the local militaries, militias, train them, fight with them. Like, there was really nothing else I wanted to do with my life at that point. But, you know, this is 2002 or 2006 while I'm at college. I'm very vocal in my support of the wars, and it's a Northeastern liberal arts school. It's not a very popular opinion or decision to join the military, but I felt like, you know, no matter what people said, this is a thing I knew I had to do with my life. And, you know, I think out of my graduating class, 508 people, 4 joined the military. I was the only person to enlist. And then, you know, I said earlier, my father, successful entrepreneur. And so it was also kind of foregoing an opportunity to walk into a family business that was doing about $20 million in revenue a year to go make $40 a day.
No wonder that chick at the Cape married him.
Right?
You know what I'm talking about? I mean, trying to play us, man. What's up?
You think we was going to catch that? You didn't
think
we
was catch that? You hear what he just said?
Said my...
Because none of the girls up at the Cape ever looked at me for some reason. I don't know why.
Were you wearing Nantucket Reds and a collared shirt?
Okay, so I didn't get into that till a little bit later. They told me, they're like, hey, you're dressed wrong. I was like, well, all right.
I don't even know what that means. All right, go ahead. Yeah, finish it up. So graduating, yep.
Yeah, so, you know, graduated in 2006, joined the Army in 2007, and, you know, did the 18 X-ray program, which essentially allows you to, I think it's probably similar to the SEAL Challenge.
Yeah, where fast track.
Yeah, fast track, right? You get to go to selection. If you get selected, you get to go to the Q course. If you make it through there, you go to the teams.
Oh, you're an SF baby.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I remember when that program came online.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that used to not be the course or the way it was. You guys had to wait a while. Used to right. be. Yeah. I remember because, but when we got hit, they
changed
that.
You had to be a sergeant before you could go in.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was kind of like relatively new at the time. People were feeling it out. There was a lot of hatred towards the 18 X-rays.
Oh, they hate it, man. I remember hearing that, bro. God dang.
You could pretty much count on, you know, people taking out a lot of hate and aggression on you as an 18 X-ray. But, you know, at the time, it was good training.
Good times. That's always a good time, yeah. I'll never forget this. Everybody I was in class with, man, they were just, you know how we are. No one talks more crap than we do about our own, especially younger next class coming in.
Yeah, so, you know, I joined in 2007. I was, you know, similar, right? Same thing as you guys going through buds, like, you know, just got pushed physically and mentally beyond anything I thought was humanly possible. But it got me really uncomfortable. It put me into a lot of different positions. There was an incredible amount of personal growth in there. And, you know, 1 year and 363 days after joining the Army, I got my Green Beret and I'm standing in formation and I'm like, all right, man, like for the rest of your life, you are always going to take the hard road. Yeah. Because this is one of the most amazing feelings.
It ever. Is, right? Like, damn.
Yeah. And so I think for me, that really just kind of set the tempo for me as to what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. Like, I just never was going to desire the easy route and always go for, you know, what was going to be the hard thing. And I'm sure it's the same with you guys. You get pinned, you try it on, you put your brand on for the first time. Like, it's the happiest moment of your life. But boy, you just don't know what's waiting for you on the other end.
The next day.
Yeah.
They don't tell you that.
Yeah.
They leave that part out. That's not even in the recruiting video. Hey, what would you say to any of the guys coming up at the Cape or come from, because we all come from different lifestyles. And that's what most people don't understand about our community in the SF is like, you got the billionaire's kid and then the poorest kid alike. The separation between us is only we kind of know what that is between the SEALs and the Green Berets and everything like that. And you figure it out more and more as you go along. But a lot of people have this there's this misconception or preconceived notion about what the military is. But it doesn't matter what your background is or what kind of family you come from, man. It's just like a university. You're stepping into it. There's fraternities in there like the Green Berets and the SEALs. It's a life within itself. I mean, did everybody try to talk you out of that when you were before you went in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's always like, hey, what are you doing? There's a war going on. Are you crazy? And I'm like, I know. That's why I need to do this, right? Or they throw out statistics of like 15% of people make it through there. And I'm like, well, I'll be one of those 15%. Yeah, it's just, I think when you go out and make a hard decision and a tough decision in life like that, you know, all of a sudden you're going to get a lot of people who think they know what's better for you, but it's ultimately up to you to decide like what is the best path for you. And a lot of these things that I went through, you know, I didn't really understand at the time, but they were just kind of training me for the rest of my life, like putting me through these situations to make sure that I was always going to do the best thing for myself.
I remember when we saw the first video and we started talking about it, and then it got to the point to where, I mean, right when I saw that, I knew that's what I was supposed to do. Like, people ask, like, how does some guys make it and some guys don't? I was like, man, there's not a doubt. Like, you know that is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And whatever I got to go through to get to it, that's different. Because that's part of the journey. And everybody's is different. Every guy, every team guy in SF has a different path. I mean, we're all in the same deal, but when you're going through it, it's like, oh, that's why they put us together. So we can understand what's happening. Because if you're going through it, well, you couldn't go through it by yourself. That's why they call it the teams. You know what I'm saying? But I remember feeling it in the pit of my stomach, not only in my heart, like the lust kind of that you see because it's cool and everybody's liking it. I mean, after everyone else stops liking it, you're like, you know what? This is exactly what I was designed for.
The way that I felt was the same way. It was like, there is nothing in life that I'm so sure that I need to be doing than this right now.
That's right. Everything else, I was like, you know, we'll do this or that. But then there's certain things you'll know as soon as it shows up, you're like, man, this is exactly what I was meant for.
Yeah. And, you know, it proved it every step of the way to me, you know, with the people that I've met and kind of you talked about this a little bit earlier. There's a lot of preconceived notions out there about the military and teams and everything of, hey, it's just poor kids. It's people don't have opportunities in life. That couldn't be further from the truth. You know, when I went to basic training, that was like one of the best cultural wake up calls for me ever, because you know, I've been going to private school since I was 12 till I was 22. From the Northeast, hadn't had a ton of exposure to around the country. And I go to basic training, I'm at infantry basic training, and all of a sudden there's just like people from all walks of life. And I'm like, this is awesome, right? I'm meeting people I never knew existed before, but we got to put those differences aside. We got to charge forward. We got missions to accomplish.
I mean, because you always hear what your parents and everybody around you says about everybody in there. And then you're scary going in there.
I mean, I found out in basic training that not everybody in the country studied Texas history in sixth grade.
I didn't know that was I thought y'all all did that.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you study Texas history all through school?
You probably studied New York history weird. In sixth grade, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I was a college grad in boot camp and thought that everybody studied Texas history in the sixth grade. Anyway, sorry.
So, you know, graduate in 2009, and because of my language, I went to the 1st Special Forces Group out in Fort Lewis in Tacoma, Washington. Our area of expertise in the world was Asia. So for me, you know, keep in mind, I'm married the whole time, married at 23. You know, my wife is kind of moving around, following me around the country, moves out to Washington. And as you guys know, right when you get to the teams, it's just like, all right, great. Pack your stuff. It's time to
get on
training or deploy here. And my first like trip overseas was to the Philippines. I was there for a month and a half, and it was a great trip because it's a tough environment. It's not like an Afghanistan or Iraq, but it was a good way for me to get my feet wet and to work with a foreign force, work with the government there. And while we were there, you know, we got the warrant out. We were going to Afghanistan. We got back from that, went to Afghanistan 4 months later, was there for 7 months. You get home on a Friday, you come back to work on a Monday. They're like, good job, boys. You're going back again in 7 months. By the way, we need you to go to Thailand. We need you to do all this training. You're going to be home for 3 months in like 2 years. So,
sounds about right.
Yeah, right? And, you know, the whole time I'm married, I see kind of my marriage disintegrating in front of my face. You know, never home. And when you're home, you're training. And definitely, you know, the period in between deployments, call that the dark winter. My wife and I, just because of the mental state that I was in, you know, the drinking that was starting there. And I had a lot of tough times. We'll go into probably later here, but a lot of people think it started after I got shot. I think the ball was already rolling down the mountain at that point, because there's just a lot of things I wasn't addressing. And for me, it was really tough to go in between deployments and just have that rapid pace like that, because I never felt like I could relax at home. So I'm like, if you relax at home here, right, you're going to let your guard down, and then you got to go back and you're going to get somebody killed here. So, you know, we went back in 2011. We went back to the same location in Kunduz up in northern Afghanistan there, working with the Afghan commandos, work with the same guys. And very lucky, right, that we have to, you know, we got to go back to the same location, right, to get to work with the same guys we had trained before. So we were able to just like hit the ground running. And, you know, there wasn't this whole like build rapport period. We were just like high-fiving, hugging each other, welcome back. Now let's pick up where we left off here. You know, from there, the deployment was great in 2011. It was much different than 2010. If you think back to 2010, a lot of the focus in Afghanistan was down at Helmand and Kandahar.
That was a gnarly year.
Just so we can clarify to the listeners, you were deployed in 2010. And
yes.
Then you were deployed in 2011.
Right. Yep. So 2010, I spent 7 months in Afghanistan, a month and a half in Thailand, and I'd say like another 3 weeks training. So maybe home for 3 months that year. And then the team, you know, we went back, did another train up in the beginning of 2011, and we were out to Oregon in March of 2011 to go back for and it was going to be an 11-month deployment, which was supposed to be at that time. I think they learned their lesson, but it was going to be an 11-month deployment, the longest special operations deployment of the GWAT. So essentially they're looking at having our team be in Afghanistan, working commando missions, doing movement to contacts for 18 out of 24 months.
And they wonder why we can't stay married.
Oh. Yeah. You bring up the point about being married. I mean, that was just brutal, right? Like going through that whole process, seeing what it was doing to my wife, you know, me kind of working through the demons on things. And then you get back in country and I tried to do a much better job communicating with my wife, kind of with the outside world, and did the best that I could in that regard. But high op tempo, things changed in 11 to 10, you know, 2010, the big focus is on the South, Kandahar, Helmand. We were up north, you know, didn't get a lot of support, didn't get a lot of supplies. 2011 comes around, they're like, wow, it's pretty bad up here. And, you know, all of a sudden we have all the air assets we need. And the more that we got, the more was expected of us. And so the op tempo of 2011 was pretty significant. And actually had the opportunity to work with Team 7 quite a bit in 2011. Some great dudes up there. And they were in Faryab province in the northwestern part. And so we would link up with them quite a bit. They were doing like a village stability operations type of thing. And we had that commando mission. So
yep.
Help them, you know, essentially patrol white space. And so actually, you know, 7 months into this deployment, we kind of have this campaign in Faryab province there. The SEAL team had just embedded into a different village. So we were helping them clear some of the valleys out, give them a little breathing room there. And it was basically just a regular valley clearing operation for us. We would get dropped off at one end of a valley, go through, look at the little clusters of mud huts, talk to people, see what was going on, you know, look for weapons caches. And like every one out of five times, we get into a firefight. And so September 25th, 2011, we're doing this kind of in support of that team out there, clearing out this valley. And we land just before the sun comes up, and you take one look at this thing and you're just like, there's that instant of like, holy shit, this is going to suck. Right.
Yeah.
You see how big the valley is. You see how many places you have to search, and you just look at it and you're like, there is like so many places to hide and fight in this thing. Like, this is just going to be.
Well, everyone we can see, there's three that we can't.
Right. And it's, you know, every step you take, right? That's your first step on that ground. But you're going up against people that know that thing like the back of their hand,
oh,
right?
Man. And I tell people that too. It's like, imagine just fighting in your own house when but somebody else showed up. And not only that, you have underground tunnels that have been there since forever.
Right. Yeah. So, you we land. I have that initial thaw. We start clearing. And just as that sun's coming over those mountaintops, that just sound like PKM, AK-47, RPG start ringing out. And, you know, one of my teammates is in a near ambush. And so, you know, a couple minutes go by on the radio that's flaring up. There's 100 different plans proposed. You're just trying to figure out what's going on. And we ultimately decide to just drop on that location, drop some bombs. And once the bombs drop, you kind of thought, hey, that's it for the day. We are, you know, that's the excitement. We got lucky. One guy got shot. But on this day, man, it really just served to embolden the enemy. Yeah. And after those bombs dropped, we went back and forth in this valley for the next 10 hours, just kind of pushing through. Yeah, until in that 10th hour of the firefight, I was going around the corner of a building trying to gain a vantage point as to how I'm going to lead my squad down the slope into a dry riverbed we're taking fire from. And all of a sudden, it felt like somebody just came up to me and hit me in the stomach with a sledgehammer as hard as they could. Yeah. I was suspended in midair. I just like think to myself, I think you've just been shot. And hey, man, never been shot before, you don't know, right?
Ta-da! What got you?
It was, let me pull it out for you right now.
Yeah, you still got it, I think, yeah.
Right there. What's up?
7.62 round right here.
Nice. Oh, good, that's nice.
You don't even have it in a box. I'd be wearing it around my neck.
I know, why haven't you?
It's in the urine sample cup that they shipped it over with.
Ah. That's even better.
Yeah.
I saw the picture on the video where they yanked it out of you.
Yeah, they pulled it out of my butt. I think they cleaned it, so.
It didn't even mushroom, did it?
No, I mean, super lucky because.
That's crazy, too, that it didn't do that. I mean, it stopped. Like, we're pushing through your soft tissue like that into your colon, and it's still.
I mean, I think that's a testament to, you know, how strong my.
How
my
tough butt your abs are?
Your six-pack abs.
You green braids, man. You guys got, you know.
Six-pack abs.
Yeah, 8 and 10-pack. Like a gay porno
can
hard, right?
Just tons clicking of steel. I mean, can it. You top bullets? I can.
Yeah. No, but I can catch them.
Yeah, I caught a bullet.
Yeah.
The bullet trap. That's awesome.
So, I mean, really lucky the way the bullet went in, it goes like an inch below the body armor.
Right? Yeah, right there.
Of course.
And it's when it went through my hip, so it fractured my hip. But got really lucky in that regard because a lot of times when a bullet hits a bone, dude, it starts bouncing or it shatters.
That's unbelievable that didn't, especially hitting you in the hip like that. God,
yeah.
God's watching out for you, man.
Oh, it's.
That sniper pretty, it was in an elevated position because it was at a downward angle. If I remember seeing the picture correctly, it.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it went down through, it's right under your navel, right, too, yeah?
Yep.
So you got two belly buttons now?
I got a nice zipper too.
Yeah, I got one of them too.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are nice. I got the front and back. So like if I had to step out this whole thing.
I've never been shot. I'm the only male in my family.
We give a lot of shit for that.
I've been shot. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I'll tell you, I'll ruin the surprise for you. It sucks, right?
Right. I'm sure it does.
There's been a helicopter crash. So, I mean, you kind of cleft out of the hole. You go either way, I think.
Yeah. You know what? I'd rather get shot than be in the helicopter crash. So I'm going to give you that one.
That's what I say too. I was like, that sounds like the most terrifying thing ever to be in one of those.
No.
Like when metal stops flying.
No.
Makes a noise. It made a noise.
Yeah. So one of your buddies was wearing a helmet cam the whole time they were working on you.
Right.
That was, how many times have you watched that? I've seen the edited version.
I have about a 40-minute reel of the whole thing. And I remember the first time watching it, it was by myself. Like, it was pretty surreal to see it. And it was amazing because I was awake for the whole thing. Right? Sure. So it wasn't like I'm seeing this the first time and saying, oh, wow.
Did they juice you or not because of the stomach injury? Normally they don't – they teach us not to juice. If you got a head injury or a bowel kind
of way. The way he was – they didn't give you any
– they didn't give you
morphine,
any,
did they?
No, they gave me fentanyl.
Yeah, that's what.
Oh, fentanyl.
Oh,
shit.
Well, there you go. on a fentanyl lollipop.
That ought to tell you how bad it hurt, because even as they were carrying him off,
oh dude,
he was still letting people know, hey, this shit sucks.
They kept yelling at me. I don't think it's in the video. Like, Kevin, don't bite it. Don't bite it. And like in my mind, I'm saying, okay, I got it. But I couldn't like formulate the words to tell them like, all right, I'm not going to bite the lollipop. I'm just going to lick it. Don't worry. But,
if you swallow that whole thing, we got to come in after. Yeah. Cause we just tape it to the hand. Right. And then that way, when you would have it, when you pass out, it just, you know, it falls right out. That was our logic, anyhow. No one ever thought that a team guy would bite that thing. I mean, like, how many licks does it take to get to the center of a fentanyl lollipop for a team guy? One.
Yeah.
Why don't you just shove this thing in my ass?
Slow rolling up the backside. Oh, that's hilarious.
So they carry. Yeah. So did you guys? Hey, for my own edification, did they get that old boy that popped you?
They did get the guy, and it's a pretty cool story. My teammate Ben Wise was the one that killed the guy. And Ben, unfortunately, 2 weeks before the team came home, he was killed in action on our team. And Ben's brother was Jeremy Wise, who was on SEAL Team 4 and then later on was contracting.
Wait.
I was about to say, man, has they got a brother?
Jeremy Chapman. Say it again.
At Chapman, right?
Jeremy Wise? Yeah.
He was killed.
So he was killed at Fob Chapman.
Yeah.
Back in it was like December 2009.
Jeremy was in my Buds class.
Was he really?
Yeah. Yes, he was.
Yeah.
I didn't know he had a Green Beret. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeremy and I graduated Buds together.
You know how small our worlds are, man.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah. So I didn't really get to know Jeremy. I knew Jeremy through Ben. Ben was best friend, man. When he died, you know, did the eulogies for him. The Bible that he and I read from, which was mine, was buried with him. Just guy taught me how to soldier, how to be a man, how to love God. Just awesome. But, you know, so Ben was on one of the ridge lines. He's the best shot on the team. He was one of our medics too. And we put him up there because he's the best shooter in. The last conversation that Ben and I had, you know, I'd gotten hurt and I'm back at Fort Lewis to do all my recovery and I'm about ready to walk into the facility. And all of a sudden I get a weird number on my cell phone. And that always meant it was a call from like Afghanistan. Guys would call me, see how I was doing. So I pick it up and it's Ben on the other line. And we're talking, do bullshit. And then it turns to the day I got shot. Right. Cause the whole day we're talking, I'm in the valley, he's on the mountain. We're talking all day coordinating and, you know, he and I started kind of running through the day. He's giving me his perspective, giving me my perspective and, you know, talks about how sad it was. He starts crying and felt like he couldn't do anything. And the team was supposed to come home in like 3 weeks. So I was like, all right, man, I can't wait to see it. It's going to be amazing. Right. And, didn't know that would be the last time that I talked to him there, but the last conversation he and I ever had was talking about that day. And, you know, it really kind of ended with him saying, hey man, I just want to let you know that we got that guy. So, yeah, that's kind of like the story behind that is, you know, the last time he and I got an opportunity to speak with each other.
God, that's terrible, man.
Well, you know how it works, man. First month and a half to 2 months and the last month and a half to 2 months, usually when we get our asses handed to us because we hadn't gotten our battle rhythms yet. We had a point man in Ramadi coming. When we were coming out of there, Chad Stodden, he's a firefighter up in Colorado, and he got hit with a round. The gunfight was on the other side of the river, and it came in, and his is still in there in front of his spine, and it looks just like your you know, that piece of jewelry you got. They're collector's items. And he still carries his in there, too. Dude, man, I jacked him up. But he's a hard dude.
But, yeah, you know, I'm happy I got to have that last conversation. It was actually an awesome piece of clarity for me. And just getting somebody else's perspective on things. And, kind of going back to the story there, you know, after kind of getting shot, I called the team up, I let them know my location. I started trying to treat myself and I, nothing I can do, right? There's just a gunshot wound to the stomach. There's nothing happening there. And the, I looked up, after calling again on the radio, I see an Afghan, and luckily he runs out. He drags me to cover, gets me behind there. People start working on me, and you know, I can hear people going up to the medic saying, like, is Kevin going to make it or not? And, right. I'm like, guys, I'm right here.
I'm listening. I can hear you. I didn't get shot in the head.
You know, a guy that I went through the Q course with who never paid me a compliment in my life is like crying, telling me he loves me. And you're just like, damn, man, like this is it here, you know?
Yeah, we need to start training our guys to, like, when something bad happens, let's say, hey, man, just talk to us. Like, hey, if you don't make it, can I have your boots? Because I would try and joke. I was working with one of my guys. He got shot in the chest, too. As I was sitting there, one of the guys was like, hey, you know, if he doesn't make it, I just want him, like, shut the fuck. What are you even talking about? I was like, we're going to make it. We're going to make it. Positive reinforcement the entire time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the only time hearts and minds come into play with us is if one of our buddies gets shot and you got to keep his ass alive. Because if he's laughing, he can't die. You can't die if you're laughing. That's a rumor. You actually live forever. If you laugh out loud, I think you get younger, actually. When we have those good, you know, we're in the team room, those good belly laughs you can only get when you're around the boys. So yeah. You'd always try and do that. One of my instructors taught me that.
Humor has got me through some pretty tough situations before getting.
Man, that's the best medicine. So how far did they litter you out right there? How far did you have to get carried with a gut shot before you got heloed out?
Yeah, it was up in the northwestern part of the country. Yeah, it was really kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So it took about 45 minutes from the time I got shot till I got loaded onto the helicopter.
You get loaded in the same spot, or did they have to transport you?
They had to transport me. So
how far was that?
I think it was pretty far for them. Yeah, they kind of, you know, it's kind of going through the maze of the Afghan village. The first movement was through an open field. They were like returning fire, receiving fire. And then they finally get me onto the helicopter.
That had to be exciting, just laying there while that was going down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We just strapped in the damn, strapped down, gutshot, and then there's a gun. Well, their guys are carrying you in a gunfight, dude. Because when we do those drills in class, you're like, this would suck in real life.
And no body armor, no helmet.
Nothing, right? Just laying it.
Sitting on a sled.
Sitting on a sled. It's awesome.
Yeah. So it had about a 15-minute ride to, like, the surgery tent. I get there. People are, like, frantically prepping for the surgery in the background. Surgeon's asking me questions and said, do you have any questions? And I was like, well, am I going to live? And he's like, I don't know, man. It looks pretty bad. What do you have any last requests? And so, you know, I asked for that bullet that I showed you guys earlier. Yeah. I don't know why, but thank God I did. And then said, I need a Catholic priest to give me my last rites because I think I'm going to die. And just remember that mask coming down my face and asking God for forgiveness for my sins and saying goodbye to this world. And then I would say my first recollection came about 4 days later. And I'm like, hey, am I in heaven or hell? And the person's like, neither, son. You're in Launchstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. And I'm like, well, all right, well, this is kind of like purgatory.
Purgatory. Here. Yeah, it's purgatory. Because I remember when I died, too. And then when I came to, same thing. Doc was standing over top of me. And I was kind of looking around. He's like, hell was full. That's why you're back. That's why I have that tattooed on my arm. Two people said that to me. And then when I got home, they gave me a T-shirt that said that.
Awesome.
All right. So, yeah, congratulations. You died, and now you're back.
Yeah. It's crazy, too, because it's like that's the mentality I feel like you got to have with guys like us, right? Like, you got to add humor into it. You got to, like, bust their balls on things.
Oh, man.
But one of my buddies comes and sees me in Germany. He got hit with two grenades and he got shot a year earlier. That's, you know, 20% of my colon's removed. My leg is paralyzed because it hit my femoral nerve. Hip is fractured, tube hanging out everywhere. And he comes in and he's like, hey, listen, man, like, plenty of people have been shot. Don't be a fucking pussy about this.
Boom, right there in the face, in the face.
And, you know, you're like, that's what you need to hear, right? You don't need people coddling you. You don't need people feeling sorry for you because that sets the tempo for yourself to feel sorry for yourself. And I spent like a week in Germany. I went to BAMSI at the Brook Army in San Antonio. When I was there, I was like, damn, man, plenty of people have been shot. Plenty of people have lost their arms. They've lost their legs. They've been burned from head to toe. And you were pretty lucky to be in the condition that you're in. I really wanted to try to keep that mindset the rest of the recovery there.
Your road to recovery, an arduous one nonetheless. You had a femoral break, femoral artery break. So they took a nerve from your left leg to the right leg, correct?
Left leg. So it's the femoral nerve, which runs like parallel to the femoral artery.
Yeah, yep. Okay. And they did a replacement then. Do you have full mobility? Actually, I saw a video of you running.
Yeah. Yeah. When I went and did the surgery, it was experimental at the time. I did it at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota.
Been there. Great place.
The best.
The best.
We've been there. Awesome place.
Awesome place.
Yeah. Can't say enough good stuff about it. At the time, the only place in the country that would do anything for me. So, went through the surgery with them. They took a nerve from my left leg. I have no feeling in my left leg. It makes for very awkward conversations after I'm like rubbing somebody's leg for an hour, sitting next to them, have no clue that I'm doing it.
No, yeah.
Nervously run through the story with them, make it even more awkward.
Right? Like Mr. Deeds.
Yeah.
Just like, go ahead, hit it.
Come on. Yeah. What's you giving?
Why would you do that?
Exactly. But did the surgery just similar to, right, like making the decision to be a Green Beret. Like, I didn't want to have regret in my life. I didn't want to look back and say I hadn't tried everything to make myself 100% better.
Should be your credo. You need to get it tattooed around your throat. Nah, regrets.
No.
Yeah. Not even a single letter.
Not one letter, huh? Not one letter.
The road to recovery that was pretty intense. I mean, it took about 18 months for me to finally get that full range of motion back. And once that range of motion was back, then you could really start to kind of build muscle up. And so I'm running again. I was supposed to run the Boston Marathon this year. I ran a 20 miler.
Yeah, they canked it. Don't even get me started on that.
I was about to say he was running one and got blowed up.
No, they canked it because of COVID.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yep. So pretty tough after you had spent 8.5 years trying to get to that point.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Because you got to qualify for the Boston, which means you're cooking if you're in the Boston, bro.
Well, I didn't have to qualify for it. Luckily.
Don't tell anybody that.
Yeah,
tell them you did.
Tell everybody you did.
Always tell everybody
you did. I had to run a 3:30 in New York to qualify for Boston, okay?
Anybody asks you if you're qualified, always say yes.
Yeah. My daughters think I'm going to win that thing. I'm just like, all right, well, let's just hope we finish
We didn't go up here to lose.
Hopefully Kipchoge's not running it.
Yeah, there's some speed there.
There's two ways to run it. You can qualify or you can raise money for a foundation. And I've been working a lot with Tom Brady's facility and trainers, Alex Guerrero, the TB12.
Yeah.
I started working with them 3 years ago, and I've been going there pretty consistently. They haven't charged me any money. They treat me for free. And
great facility. I saw the highlights on that too, with there and there, they're pulling you back too.
Are y'all even allowed to talk about Tom Brady anymore?
You can't talk about Tom Brady anymore. What happened what happened to your back? Just because I just came out of a back procedure on Friday. I remember seeing you saying that Christmas Day that you were in such bad shape with your back that's what led you to TB12, right?
Yeah. So that was back like Christmas 2016, I believe, 16 or 15. I had to watch the girls, two little girls, open their presents while I laid on the floor because my back hurt so bad. And then the rest of the day just kind of plied with muscle relaxers, laying on the couch while they're playing with their Christmas presents. And that was a big wake up call for me. He said, when I was back at group for the last 2 years in the military, went to physical therapy all day. I got out, started a career, went to school, started a family. My health kind of took a backseat to things. And it's kind of, the military mentality of like, you got to put everybody else's needs above yourself, right? Like, I was putting my family's needs above mine. And I was the lowest person there. And that day, that morning, I realized that, like, if I didn't start to put my health back as a priority again, not because I was being selfish. If I didn't do that, then I was just going to be nothing to nobody, because this was the end result of me neglecting that and putting everything above my mental health, my physical health. And so that was a big wake up call for me. And that's how I was kind of led to the TB12 centers there. And really what was wrong with my back was just, for at that point, 5-6 years, you know, my gait had been thrown off completely with my leg, and, you know, I had to relearn how to walk in a certain way. Yeah. And the human body's amazing. It's going to learn how to do these things.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Doesn't mean it's going to be good for the body, though, right? Like,
something's got to give.
Yeah. So it threw off so much stuff that I would have so many back problems, neck problems, shoulder problems with everything. Jeez.
You need to join our fraternity.
You're in it. Yeah, that's what right. This is.
Yeah. So that's kind of what led me to that, to understand that it was all right for me to put these things as a priority again. Right? It was all right for me to put my physical therapy, my mental and emotional health as a priority, because if I could get those things in line, right, then I'm going to be a significantly better husband, better father, employee, just person in general.
Yeah.
And TB12 played a huge role in that, reducing my pain levels and getting me back out there doing the things I wanted to be doing in my life.
So after the gunshot wound and then the rehabilitation, then retired from the military, this is where I want you to, because your next phase of your life, your next chapter, when you turn that page, is amazing to me. Because I turned into an academic too after I got out of the military. And you got your MBA and your MPA from two of the most prestigious schools in the country, in the world, arguably. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I think it's just proof that people make bad decisions. And when they make those bad decisions, I take them up on their offer there, right?
Which one did you get into? Did you get MIT or Harvard first?
So this is, you know, for me, I always get what I want and just takes a long time. Probably because I'm more willing to take more abuse than anybody else, and I'll be the last man standing.
Bullshit. Who you think you're talking to, man? I didn't go there yet. I'm still taking the shit.
Yeah. Going to grad school, I would say probably pretty similar to like getting a Green Beret was a big, fat, hairy goal that I had for myself. And then after the surgery, right when I found out I need to go to the Mayo Clinic, that's when Ben was killed. Right, so I get those two pieces of news. Ben's killed, and guess what? You have to have this huge surgery again. And it sent me to a downward spiral, man, and became addicted to my pain meds, right, and with substance abuse, bitterness, depression, anxiety. I needed a goal, right? I needed a big thing again to get me out of bed, right, something that was huge I could focus my attention on. And my wife really kept reminding me of, like, hey, grad school. And similar to like when I was I want to be a Green Beret. I'm like, all right, let's set the bar as high as we can. And if you fall short, then you still achieved a lot. So I said, I want to go to like an Ivy League school for grad school. And this is, since I was shot, right, from the exact moment after I got shot, it has been the most humbling experience in my life. But looking back on it, it was needed, right? I needed that humbling to make me into the person that I am today. But in my hubris, I applied to three schools, man. I applied to Harvard Business School, to the MIT School, the Sloan School of Management, and the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And I was like, that's enough. That's me. I'm going to get in, right? Like, no big deal, right? So didn't even leave room for a backup. And the rejection letters start coming in, and Harvard Business School, the Harvard Kennedy School. And I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not as special as I thought that I was here. And then I got waitlisted at MIT. So I bought a plane ticket from Seattle to Boston. I flew across the country. I walked up to the admissions office unannounced, thanked them for my spot on the waitlist, and said, all right, now what do I need to do to get in here? And you know, once they took that finger off the panic button, they sat down with me and we talked a little bit. 3 months later, I got into the school. And that fall, I swallowed my pride. I reapplied to the Harvard Kennedy School. And then I was accepted the second time around to pursue those concurrent master's degrees.
What was it like going to both those schools? I've had a couple of buddies that did the same programs that you did, which I thought was sheer lunacy. But challenging enough is just one of those particular schools, especially those programs in grad school. But doing both of them at the same time,
more importantly, do you tell people that you're doing both of them? Kind of like telling everybody you're a Green Beret. We just don't do that. But when you do tell them that, no one believes you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you're not doing both those. It's impossible.
It's like, why would you do
you're
that?
You're full of shit, right?
Like, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, lunacy, I think that's probably the right word for it. you know, I had like a couple weeks in between moving across the country, getting out of the military, starting school a week before midterms in that first term. My wife, you know, we had our first child.
Throw that in there.
Yeah,
throw that's a good idea. He's going to be up anyways.
Hey, 40 out of 100 is good, right?
That's right. Like,
yeah.
For us.
Statistics.
Get that snowflake.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things that was hard about it is you kind of have this imposter syndrome, and you're like, well, hey, do I really?
Okay, I know really what that is, and I'm since it's undiagnosable, but I'm almost positive I have it. Do you have it too?
Yes, yes.
It's a very real thing. Real thing. I actually, when I got back into grad school, I started researching it hard and heavy, and a lot of us have it. You're the first person I've ever heard out loud say that.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. Most people have I've never even heard of it.
I mean, I think if people were more honest with themselves, they would, the majority of people would say that there. And so, yeah, I mean, I think I struggled with that, and then struggled with the fact of, you know, you're in an environment, and I was the only Green Beret. I don't think there wasn't even any SEALs in my class. There wasn't Rangers, nobody with a special operations background. So I'm all of a sudden thrust into this environment. I'm 29 years old, and I'm like, what do I even talk to people about here? And, you know, how do I tell them what I've done in my life and my story without them thinking I'm crazy or in a manner in which they can understand it. So
did one of your professors at school bring that up to you? Imposter syndrome? How did you find out about that?
I can't remember.
I had one of my professors at Harvard say that to me. She brought that up to me. She's like, have you ever heard of this? I think you may have it.
Yeah.
And that's how I found out about it.
I just knew it from probably a lot of the self-doubt that I was.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I didn't know there was a name for it.
But here's the thing though, right? And then you get your 40 back on your exam and you're like, okay, well maybe I shouldn't have gotten it. Maybe they were right to put me on the wait list. So it kind of bring me down an option. It forced a lot of reflection on, a lot of inward reflection for myself. And I think it forced me to think about how I was thinking about other people, starting to let go of a lot of the bitterness and the cynicism that I had built up over the years. I had never worked harder in my life to attain below average results. And I would walk into school every day and I'd be like, man, do you really want to do this? Cause you're going to raise your hand and say something stupid and embarrass yourself again today. But, over time, like the grades picked up, the speed of the classroom slowed down for me. It really started taking people's advice, reach out to people for help.
Yes.
You know, started journaling, practicing.
That's a battle rhythm.
Yeah.
That's great advice. Would you say that's some of the most sound advice that you ever received? Is like, hey, reach out for a lifeline. It's okay. Yes. Especially to our military brothers and sisters that are in the SF community. Hey, you can do that. And it doesn't matter if they are in a SF community or we're in the SF community or not. If they're, I did that in grad school all the time. People are like, hey, don't be scared to reach out and ask for help. And I was like,
yeah,
it took me like the end of my second year to figure that out.
That's same thing, right? Like, I just wish I did it sooner. It was humbling in the sense of too, right? Like I kind of had this chip on my shoulder and, you know, I went through this period of thinking, well, what have other people done with their lives? Right. Cause they didn't serve. And I think grad school really showed me that there's people doing a lot with their lives. Just because you weren't in the military didn't mean that
everybody else builds this place. We protect it. So, I mean, you can't look at it any other way than that.
Yeah. And that was something that was like a character flaw, right, that I had to deal with. And, you know, then say to myself, all right, well, hey, this like 25-year-old girl who's one of your best friends, like she's going to be able to help you navigate your career and interview prep. And you got to accept her help. And, you know, so just humbling.
Is that what that syndrome is?
No.
Well, both of you are talking about it. And I'm sure everyone out there, if no one's heard of it, then they have no idea what you're talking about.
So imposter syndrome, if you look in the DSM-4, it's not an actual diagnosed disease, but imposter syndrome is when you accomplish great things in your life and you always internally say it was accidental. It must've been lucky. I don't deserve this. It's like when I graduated from Harvard, it was just the only reason I graduated Harvard is because I was a team guy, not because I went to the school, did the classes. It's because they thought that in my mind that the only reason I went there is because I was in spec war. It is a characteristic or a functionality of an individual that refuses to allow themselves to accept accomplishment. Would that be a good articulation of that, do you think, Kev?
Yeah, no, I would agree.
Well, I didn't get into Harvard, so I'm really proud of you. I think that's foolish. both y'all, good job.
So the down part
coming from the guy who didn't make it in there.
Yeah, so but the downside to imposter syndrome is that you're never, in our eyes, it may not be something that you're never satisfied. You will never have a sense of accomplishment in your life.
Yeah, you're staying hungry.
You always think that it's accidental or it is, there was a loophole, or if you want to add to this, Kevin, you can. That's about the gist of it right there. Okay.
Well, that's where you're just working in a team and somebody else is pulling the weight to get the entire mission done. And when you're in there doing it yourself,
so like you can't guys, take full- like you said, Kev, is like, man, when my first year in grad school, I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm working my ass off here and I'm not doing well. Do I really deserve to be in this program? You're at MIT and Harvard, but you're not top of the class and you're an SF guy. Okay. You come from the 1% of the world's population. How could you not be the top of the class? I don't belong here. And then, once it starts to unfold, after you graduated, how you felt about, after you graduated, you have 2 degrees from Harvard and MIT, two of the most prestigious schools in the world. But I would ask you, is there a sense of accomplishment there? Like when you graduated from the Q course, which it probably is, but the best way to say this, some people hang their hat on the fact that they have degrees from those schools. Is it just another thing for you?
I think for me, it's just another thing. It's not to downplay those institutions or like just.
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah. But I had this pretty surreal moment when I was like 26 or 27 on my second deployment, and we're flying 2 a.m. on a Chinook. You know, you guys know the drill, right? You're getting ready to go do a raid on a village. And I look back and I'm like, wow, I'm in charge of all these guys and this is amazing. And I was like, you know, I hope this isn't like the coolest you're ever going to be in your life. And
high school football, 4 touchdowns, right?
Yeah,
keep going. Hey,
I was all state in my senior year. Just going to throw that out there. But
see? Yeah. All right, Al Bundy.
But, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that I want to kind of consistently do for the rest of my life is it's almost a fear. Like, I don't want to peak at 26 or 27. And so I just want to consistently go out there and try and achieve to the best version of myself, right? For me, like what is, you know, really ascribed to what success looks like for me, and just continue to get after it and not hang my hat on anything that I've done in the past.
Right. I just learned a couple of weeks ago, best phrase I ever heard. Andre Agassi said it. There's no finish line.
I was about to say, man, we're
ever.
We're SF, man. We fought in the mountains. The highest peak leads to the lowest valley. And then the peaks in between and the plateaus. It's kind of like when we work out in the gym. People get frustrated because they hit those plateaus. Well, that's actually good. It lets your body rest. It lets you see what you've just climbed. It lets you see what you're fixing to climb. And you can enjoy the view. And then as we get our just remember, you climb that highest mountain, you're not going to go back down the way you came, going over the backside. That's a new route.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, climbing up's one thing. Falling down, I'm real good at that. And SF guys, all we do is fall down.
Yeah.
I mean, we keep doing that. That's a humbleness that's been beat into us. And when you try to transfer that into that world, especially at those schools, because a lot of them guys, once they get those certificates, they don't have to explain shit to you. They don't have to justify themselves. That's actually with that piece of paper normally, they can just burn up and tear up, whatever. But that carries a lot of weight. Same way, you know, in the civilian world, they get the paper. In the military world, we get metal. That's why they put medals on your chest, because you go through that stuff like you did. First, you got your medal, and then you went in and finishing up. I mean, the most lethal weapon is up here in our mind, right? It controls this whole little mechanism. So We sharpen ourselves through combat and the people that are around us. Everyone's a stone, and we're blades. They're going to polish you, dull you, or sharpen you. And then the sharper you get in your mind, especially as we get older, it makes you more lethal. I mean, that's always how we looked at it.
All right, so multiple combat deployments as a Green Beret, wounded in action, the longevity of rehab and everything that you had to go through, picked yourself back up, had a great foundation from family and support groups. Obviously, I read that as well, that your wife was your rock.
Dude, we need to meet her. Was she there? Bring her. Dude, that's, I mean.
Because they were, you said high school, high school sweetheart. You guys got married in college or right after?
We got married right after. We met the first couple weeks of our freshman year of college.
We lived
1 floor above mine.
Oh, you said high school. I was like, oh, okay, cool, sweet. That's awesome.
Bro, how long have you guys
been married now? So what, like 15 years maybe?
We got married when we were 23, so about 13 years now.
Okay.
Get 13. That MIT thing going. Come on, yeah. Math. Come on.
All right. And
I mean, so I'm not just, an accountant, but I
just
got...
The gravity of your wounds and everything that you all had to go through together. You got back up on your feet, literally and figuratively, went back to grad school, to Harvard and MIT, and now you work for a company, and your role and responsibility is, if I understand this right, it's almost like leadership development and strategic and tactical decision making in this, what is it, like a $40 million year company, right?
Sounds made up. Sounds like something like a team guy would totally identify with.
Right. So it's like,
you're partially right there. It is, the job was made up for me.
Of course it was.
I spent a couple of years.
Actually, it was always there. You're just the only one that got qualified to do it.
Yeah.
Think about, like, hey, positive motivation all the time.
I was in finance for a couple of years. Good experience. Learned a lot. Just
at Goldman, right? At Goldman?
Yeah. Great place to be, right? If you want to be in finance, finance wasn't a great fit for me. And so I was able to get in front of the CEO of the company that I'm working at right now and kind of ran him through the story we just talked about and said, if you can let me lead people, mentor them, motivate them, solve problems and learn, I'll give you a high ROI. Trust me. And I was like, I don't know what I want you to do here, but I want you on the team. So you're going to be the director of strategic projects.
And yes. What is that?
I can do that.
That sounds exactly like what I need to be doing.
Yeah. And so it's a lot of, right, like strategic initiatives that come down from a company. It's, you're building a company. It's very similar to being a Green Beret, and you're building a military. Right. So a lot of the lessons learned, the problems you're going to face are going to be, you know, pretty similar along the way there. And so that was one of the great challenges that I saw with that was, you know, how do we get these projects from A to Z, right? How do we make sure the right people are there? People are bought in, they're motivated to do it. But also too, kind of working with people along the way, younger people at the company, first time managers, the opportunity to give them mentorship about leadership and project planning. So it's been an amazing experience. I've been there for almost 2.5 years now, and I've learned quite a bit throughout that journey there.
So you're bilingual, not in a sense like you speak Mandarin Chinese and English and whatever the language you speak, because you went to the language schools of your graduate programs at MIT and Harvard. You have the ability to speak business, but you also have the ability to speak, because I'm a big veteran advocate when it's trying to get veterans jobs once they exit the military, because we don't speak the same languages. There's a disconnect between what the civilian world says and thinks and how the military world operates, because my resume in the military doesn't translate very well into the business world, because if I read my resume and they have, well, what can you do? Well, I was a sniper. What do you do? Well, I kill people. Well, you can't do that here, right?
I blow shit up, kill people, bro. That's what I do.
Okay, well, I can't have you
door
running.
Kicker.
I can't have you in my accounting department. Well, I guess you could. Well, anyway, you see what I'm saying? So I applaud you because you have taken the steps to not only maneuver through the business space, and even at the special, it's where you are now, you could very well articulate it as a special operations community because of your background in the business world.
Right into that.
And you're a Green Beret. So you have that look angle. You have that perspective to say, hey, look, and if any other company is looking for veterans out there, you have the ability to say, hey, look, if you're looking for someone that does this, a
an A-Team Bravo can do this for you. Not only because they do this in the military, but this is the kind of individual you're looking for here. And then you can tell that to the... I just think that what you're doing is so special. And again, I applaud you for it. So, you know, people most... I mean, so a lot of people sit back and just rest on their laurels alone and just don't do anything with it.
Learning how to tell that story and sell myself was... That was part of the humbling project that, you know, going to grad school and everything for me, because the first time I interviewed for my summer internships, I got rejected by 16 out of 17 companies. The reason why I got the one internship was because a MARSOC colonel interviewed me and knew my resume, but he's like, son, you have got to learn how to interview here. Yeah.
So you need all those rejection letters. Those are the ones we hang up on the walls. Right. Not the good stuff that we write. Not the one that we made it through. Like, which ones you get into? I don't even remember, but these are the ones that didn't let me in.
So that was a moment where I was like, look, man, you gotta really take a look at how you're presenting yourself to other people. And you really have to learn how to tell this story to other people so that they can understand it and understand the value that you bring to them in a manner.
Yeah. 16 rejection letters. That has to be the first time that you lost. The first time since you were an SF guy, the first time that you lost, and a lot of the veterans that are getting out of the military and they get into the civilian world and get those rejection letters and get their asses kicked, they don't rebound very well.
Well, man, did they not get their asses kicked in selection? Because I would get those.
But then how often do you lose when you're at the team? Your teammates don't let you lose.
That's a great point. I guess the definition changes.
Yeah.
Right.
And hey, I've had to have that talk with some guys where I'm like, hey, look, man.
Standard changes of what that is.
Yeah. There was a point in your life where you had enough courage to put everything on the line and go to selection or go to buds or, you know, any of these things.
Oh, that's an ego thing. That's what that is.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing to step that pride and that ego with. We're team guys, that kind of deal.
Yeah.
Like a lot of us get out and you want to go straight into the boardroom and do us like, man, start in a mailroom or start back at school. Right. Work your way up from just like we did in the beginning. And that way you don't have to worry about having to talk about it, because then you're just, no one wants to talk to the guys at the bottom. They're trying to learn everything. It's not that you think that you're better. It's just, hey, like, you've earned your stripes. Age is rank too.
It's just like I say to guys, I'm like, look, man, like, you wouldn't, just because somebody knocks it out in the civilian world, like, you wouldn't let them come in at like a captain or a major, right? They got to start at the bottom. They got to earn
it. It wouldn't be a team leader.
That's exactly how I explain that. Hell, if Mojo and I came into y'all's team room and you were fixing to go out, even though we were operators, he wouldn't let us roll with you. You're like, man, you didn't do the work up. I mean, I know what you are, but that doesn't mean, I mean, it's a cohesive balance. If you just throw something in there, because that used to happen to us, man. They just bring some guys in that wanted to roll with a team one night. And I'm like, man, you know, that would always make me more nervous than anything when they dropped somebody in that I wasn't. Especially when I got into a leadership role. When you're young, you don't care. You know, whatever, just as long as I don't take my job. When you get up, you start thinking about everybody else. But, yeah, that's all of that comes into play. I mean, hell, after a while, you're training that whole team. Take them out of their suits and ties and throw a freaking uniform on them and see how close it is from the planning to the training, from mobility. This is how you need to get to work. This is the most efficient way. This is how, I mean, you can line it out just like that, because that's what we were trained to do. And then you went in, Morgan, talking about you speaking multiple languages. That's a real thing. You know how, like, SEALs, we can't talk to pilots. They don't even listen to us, right? Unless you get a JTAC or a FAC. Same way with you guys. We always got along so well with the Green Berets, especially if one of the bastards walked in. Like, if I walked in, I was like, I'm an 18 Delta. Boom, ice broken right there.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. Your story is just...
I enjoyed this, man. Yeah, I learned it.
I've said it 100 times. I'm just beside myself that you continued to move forward and you didn't take everything that happened to you and made an excuse out of it.
So I don't have, I have no idea how hard those programs that he's talking about are, but watching his face when he speaks about you, knowing what my brother's been through, it must've been something. Do you understand me? So good job.
What's a piece of never quit advice you could leave for our listeners?
Yeah. The biggest piece of quit, or I almost said piece of shit advice.
Here's the biggest piece of shit advice I can give somebody.
Here's some shit quit advice right now. That's a t-shirt right there.
Don't listen to me.
Shit quit advice.
Going on the wall.
That's good, dude.
The biggest never quit advice I can give you is this. Is, you know, a lot of people don't believe it when I tell them that getting shot was the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And the reason being is because it forced me to pass through a valley of humility. Right? I had to walk a mile in so many other people's shoes that I wouldn't have. Depression, anxiety, substance abuse, post-traumatic stress, everything, right? If I hadn't gone through those, I wouldn't be the person I am today. And because I went through those experiences, I have the ability to empathize with people, understand a lot more about the troubles that people have in their lives. It's made me a better husband, better father, citizen, employee of this country. And it gave me incredible perspective on life and a ton of lessons learned to be able to go out there and share with other people to just make them into the best version of themselves. And so, you know, what I would really encourage people, right, to never quit is when you're going through these hard times, right? Like I did for years on end, where I just wasn't sure if there was even going to be an end to this thing, right? You have to understand that hard times in life are not a bad thing, right? They're a gift. Those hard times are a gift for you to scrape off the rough edges, to learn a lot of lessons, to walk a mile in some other people's shoes, refine your character. And when you can view it that way, that's going to give you that extra strength, that extra motivation to lift your head up, see what's happening, and you can push through that hard time. And you get to that other end, and trust me, you're going to be thankful you went through that.
Well said.
That was great.
Absolutely. And just to point this out, I think one of the greatest parts about being a team guy and going through that and then being in the world that you're in is that you don't forget the separation between where you're at now and where you were. Because a lot of people can't relate. They'll be like, man, I don't even know how could you even understand that? But because of us and I think when we join the military, that's the age we're stuck at. Like the minute they take that civilian and they put that SF into us, we're forever 23.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you got to get back out and try to regrow back up.
Yeah.
I mean, I watch all the guys do it. And in my perspective, it had to be unique. And
I don't know if this has happened to you yet, but I got to think that in your company, when sugar turns to absolute shit and everybody's folding and falling apart, you honestly have got to stand up and go, well, at least there's nobody shooting at us.
Yeah, I mean, this is when it gets
good. We ain't been shot yet. It can always get worse.
Right. You know, I think it's always good to have that perspective.
And you have like, that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, did you do this? Wear a shirt that's too short and lean back in your chair and stretch and let them see the zip.
What happened?
And then somebody starts complaining.
Some asshole shot me in
the stomach.
After I think the first 2 months that I was there, I had the opportunity to address the company and, you know, did like a 35-minute presentation for them. They saw that video and kind of ran through my story and a lot of the lessons learned. So. It was good for them to see where I was coming from on my perspective on things.
Those are the gifts that give me. I bled out of my stomach for a year.
You're absolute somebody. You are the man that people can lean on. I mean, don't ever forget that. So the things that you've been through, people will gravitate to that when they're in need or in trauma. They're like, hey, give me something. Even if they don't reach out a lifeline to you and ask for it, I know that you're more than willing to give it to them because of your humbleness. I see that. Man, that you're just value. If I was talking to your CEO right now, like you need to give this man a raise.
Well, should take his desk and his chair away from him and make it hard in there. No light bulb. All right, man. Thank you, dude.
Buddy, I honestly enjoyed this conversation with you, man. I've had a great time chatting with you, buddy.
Hey, this was awesome, guys. It was just like being back in the team room again.
It's good, right? Yeah, back in the tribe. That's awesome.
Hey, Kevin, we open line here. Do you have anything you want to plug? What you got going on? How can people follow you?
Yeah. If you'd like to hear a little bit more about me, my story and, you know, just I candidly put it all out there. Right. There's nothing that I won't cover, you know, talk about substance abuse, depression, post-traumatic stress, just in hopes that people glean something from my story. So you can follow me on Instagram at Wounded by War, Facebook, I have a Wounded by War page. You can follow me on LinkedIn, just Kevin Fleick. I'm also on the board of the Green Beret Foundation. It was a place that was near and dear to my heart. They were there for my wife and I from day one.
They're a great organization.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep.
Like, yeah.
I'm wearing my Green Beret Foundation shirt right now.
Boom. Notice that. Yep. You guys come to the, you guys come.
I've been to a couple of the galas.
Y'all come to the NSF Brain Symposium every year out in San Diego.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, I love it. I've been on the board for 18 months now. It's an incredible organization. We're doing great things. So check them out. And, you know, one of the best parts about where I'm at right now is I have the ability to speak throughout the country to companies, to organizations, and just share my story, share the lessons I learned, and help teams, individuals, companies become more resilient. So, you know, you can DM me through that, or you go to my website at www.woundedbywar.com.
Great.
Awesome. Hey, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the podcast. Let us know what you think. Follow Kevin. Make sure you check him out on social media. If you want to follow us on social, it's teamneverquit.com/social. Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And hey, leave us a review too if you like the show. Kevin, thank you so much again for joining us. Thank you guys for subscribing. We'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Later, bye, buddy.
God bless. I had to tell you one thing too, Marcus. So I'm working on a book right now, and I'm working with a woman named Dr. Alice Atalanta. And she wanted me to tell you that the reason why she got involved in starting to help veterans like tell their stories was because of you.